just to kind of kick things off, we connected back in February to record Golf Homies podcast, which we're still working on editing, and you know, events that are going on that have been going on for a long time. And if you'd reach back out wanting to
have another conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate the opportunity. You know, I think I know you and I know your spirit and I know the organization and I know what you've represented since the first time I met you. So, yeah, I think it's, I think more conversations like this are needed and yeah. Help, you know, they help us all process what the hell's going on.
Yeah, I think in terms of, you know, what we're all looking to get out of this is having a raw conversation where we can listen, we can learn, we can talk about the issues and how we can actually make a change through motion and action versus just talking about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And hearing perspective and experiences from yourself and from others in the Black community is how we start to understand better and start to break down these structures that are put in place and educate and continue to like figure out, you know, how do we continue to move forward with this and not let it.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously momentum. I don't know what you call it. I guess we call it momentum, attention,
awareness,
yeah, frustration, anger, mm-hmm. Resistance, uprising, whatever we call what's going on. But in preparation for our conversation, I just tried to look and see what's out there from smart people and figure out what, you know, people who have more wisdom, more experience, leadership qualities, whatever, are doing. And there's certainly some positive stuff happening in terms of, you know, the cause or the issue that's in front of us now specifically is police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I listened to a little bit of a podcast this morning. Of course, I can't remember the guy's last name. His name is D-Ray. He does a pod, Save the People, on, you know, he has a podcast. And he's amazing. He's doing he has a project going on where I think it's like, I mean, of course I'm blank now, but the ideal behind it is no police, no deaths by at the hands of police. And another kind of subset of that organization where I believe there's 8 changes that police forces can make quick, just in their policies, and it drops, you know, deaths by police officers by like 72%. And they're not crazy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about certain things that people thought would work, like having the police officers more engaged with the community. Well, that doesn't drop police violence. And just this number of things, and they have been tracking data for 6 years. And man, when I hear, you know, we're golfers. I'm a, you know, data, right? In every sport, baseball is probably where it started. And physiology and the body and stuff like that. So someone who's gone and tracked the data for police forces around the country and then looked at police forces that, you know, for example, talking about having more Black officers on the police force. Well, there's no change at 5%, 10%, 20%, 25%, 30%. 35%, it drops. Like, what a crazy number, right? You know, not 30%, but 35%. If 35% of the police force has Black officers, then there's a decrease. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, thankfully, there's people like him and others out there who we can turn to and look to. And I've got to educate myself. I think that's the call to action right now. Is before we really do anything, I think there's an opportunity to go learn,
mm-hmm.
and you know, open up our hearts, because you know what I see on Instagram is a dark hole, is a deep hole, you know.
Yeah.
And I lost probably 4 nights. My wife is working her behind off. like working till like 10 or 12 at night with her job, which is intense. She works for the school system, but you know, I'm in bed on Instagram, and police brutality this past week knows no color. I mean, Asian young girl, I mean, just punched in the face. I mean, she had to have had a fractured eye socket or broken nose. You know, white, black, people just get, I mean, hit by police cars, pushed, pepper spray. I mean,
rubber bullets.
Yeah, rubber bullets lodged in people's foreheads. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just no, it's not necessary. And a lot of it is at peaceful protesting. Obviously, there's another subset of people who are breaking the law. And I think there's a conversation that needs to be had around that. It's terrible, but I understand the energy behind it for sure.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't take away from the peaceful protesting that is going on and the reaction from police to that.
Right, like, right. And there's some good police out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see some police out there taking a knee and embracing the protesters. Shoot, in Raleigh, you know, I think the key word, I think, you know, the police force was like, we support the people protesting. It got out of hand. That scares me, you know? So where's the answer lie there? I have a really close friend who lost her store.
Yeah,
pretty crazy.
With the, like, the podcast that you were listening to and the data that they're collecting, like, have they found any police forces or stations, I don't know, that are exemplifying, like, what they should or acting how they should, and, like, how do they scale that? Or does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. What he said was there are 8 things that need to be done.
Right.
Policy changes. Number one, and mayors have a lot of oversight. The mayor and the police chief can change them all pretty much overnight. Campaign zero. There it is. So there are police forces who have made those changes. He did not mention them by name, but it sure is nice to hear there's some hope, you know?
Yeah. How do we take that and spread that contagiousness?
Exactly. Like, that's something I can embrace.
That is definitely one of the many systematic problems, is the police brutality. I think that is, like you're saying, the first one we need to focus on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what got all of our attention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Secondarily, I think what I've been researching a lot about would be more so like the incarceration side of things. So the actual criminal justice system and how it fails due process and nonviolent crimes, like the amount of time that people are being thrown away in jail for crimes that they're not even proven guilty of yet,
right,
that are nonviolent.
Maybe and they can't pay bail.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's another area that I think is definitely important to look at too, in terms of what I've seen in doing some research and education.
Yeah, it's funny. Fortunately or unfortunately, I haven't been part of the criminal justice system. So it's not as front and center for me, you know what I mean? But definitely I'd be interested to...
I think it probably also stems from the police brutality and the whole attitude towards, you know what I mean?
Like over policing and all that stuff. And over use of force.
Escalation.
Not using proper de-escalation. Something popped in my head that DeRay McKesson. There we go. I think that's it. But he said, he was talking about one of the policies that police forces should take on is not to shoot in a moving car. Why? Well, if you shoot the passenger, the car's still moving, so it's going to kill somebody. Very, very possibly it's going to hit something else. Like, well, that's kind of common sense. So you don't necessarily have to shooting inside of a moving car. You shoot at tires, shoot in, who knows? You know what I mean? Very, you know, kind of common sense if you think about it, but that type of policy saves lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you, I think learning through perspective is important in other people's story and experiences. Do you have any particular stories that you'd feel comfortable sharing that can maybe give some perspective on maybe? So I think in terms of like people that don't believe they are racist, right? But there's still innate prejudice that is in their train of thought and things like that, that show in everyday society. Maybe not, you know, they're not like...
Not actively.
Actively.
Yeah. Not carrying a flag, not wearing a hood.
Right.
Yeah.
But, and they, you know, claim, and I'm not racist, right. But there's still these built-in prejudices and biases and gut feelings that are brought about by years and years and years of the environment they've been in, media,
yeah,
pop culture,
you know, parents, grandparents,
yeah,
history books, yeah, all that. I mean, I'll just start with watching that video. I mean, I didn't watch all of it. I watched like the first, I don't know how many minutes, and when I saw he was about to, man, I had to forward because I just never had like a gut feeling like that where I felt like all the air was sucked out of my body. Like I felt like I was losing my life. So I just, you know, starting there, it wasn't even anger. It was just between listening to a guy ask for help and knowing what the result was. Like we knew he had been killed and begging for help. Can't breathe, stomach hurts, people are saying his nose is bleeding. Then the thing that got me later was when we found out he was crying for his mother, who had died 2 years before. That was the gut punch. I was just like, man, I can't comprehend that. And, you know, for me, that was probably the most graphic representation of, you know, my studies. We're going to go down a weird part of my life where, you know, grew up in Raleigh, grew up in Durham, Chapel Hill, played golf my whole life. Usually the only black guy, one of a few black guys. But I was pretty well accepted, but I knew racism and prejudice was there and heard things. Things that, you know, come back to me 10 years later. It's like, wow, that was not meant as a compliment, you know, or that wasn't meant lovingly. And, you know, a lot of it, when I caught it, there was a problem. You know, I addressed it. Some people I just cut out of my life. But, you know, going to historically black college, went to Hampton University on the golf scholarship, played there, and my goal was to be a graphic design major, do something in golf, and try to play all that stuff. And then I moved to history, political science, and really started studying history and realizing what I didn't know, what I hadn't been taught. And man, this ugly part. I mean, we all know about slavery. We all know about the civil rights movement. But in between there, you know, in the after the Civil War, there's a great period where there's integration. There was black folks and state senates, Congress, you know, nationally and stuff like that. And then when the troops were taken out of the South, it got ugly. And what I realized, there were a lot of lynchings, you know. And there was an article in the local Independent, you know, and there was a book called, good gracious, I'm blank today. But it was Lynching Photography. And the guy was doing an exhibit, and I was going. I was like, I can't do this. I can't handle it. But I got my hands on the book later, and I mean, it's like, I don't know if it's 100 pages, 60 pages, whatever, but all visuals of black people with ropes around their neck. And I mean, it's disturbing, but motivational, another thing. But it's just that visual is what I went back to when I saw that. A knee on this guy's neck. You know, that was the closest I'd ever been to that. And guys, I'm just being as, you know, I'm being raw. So talk to me. But so I just can't imagine. I can't explain to you the feelings that I felt over the past couple weeks, because on top of that, I've been in situations where a police officer was escalating the situation mm-hmm. with me. Last time I got pulled over, driving back from the beach with my wife, speed limit went from 65 to 55. I was driving 74. And the smart people in the pack fell back, and I'm by myself. Police officer pulled me over. It's a black police officer pulling the parking lot. And I was just like, man. And I was in a good place mentally, you know. So this is a good thing. But he had his head in the window and was aggressive. Like he wanted a fight. I said, man, I'm sorry. I know the speed limit changed and I didn't slow down, and he was just barking at me. And I took it real well, and I was just apologetic. I've never been apologetic before. But thank God that time I was apologetic. And my wife, you know, he had his hand on his gun. I think it was unstrapped. He was ready to go. And my wife, at one point, I looked over at her when I think I reached for my license, and her eyes were big, and she looked concerned, and it just went through my head, oh, that's what's happening. You know what I mean? And so that's the last time I got pulled over, got a ticket, you know, whatever. That was my fault. But, you know, that's a reality that when I see a police car, there's a level of anxiety and fear that goes through my body that I just don't know that you guys feel. And that's the type of conversation that I think we need to have. Mm-hmm. That, you know, when the whole thing with Trayvon Martin went through, you know, and I live in a neighborhood with a police station, a local community police station, less than a mile away, half a mile away, I can walk to it. And so for probably 6 months, I didn't walk my dog in the neighborhood. My wife is like, we got to walk the dog. I was like, you can go. And I was just, it was just like, I don't want a neighbor to give me that look, because right now I'm fired up, you know, like, is this your neighborhood? What are you doing here? And I don't want a police officer. I used to be a real nice guy, and I would wave at the police, and they would drive by. I wouldn't wave. I actually had an altercation one time with a guy with road rage, where he pulled up beside me, white guy, and act like he was pulling the trigger at me. And I pulled up beside him and like halfway cut him off. This is on 6th Road, and I said, you're going to act like you're going to shoot me over... Over what? Like, I didn't even do anything. Like, so he made a right on a red light, and I was making a left on the green light. And I kind of, I don't even think I did anything at first. But I looked in my rearview mirror. Maybe I put my hand up, like, be careful, don't hit me, you know? I didn't flip him off or freak. And he followed me for a solid mile and was looking for a fight, you know, trying to pick a fight. His son was in the back seat, in a car seat. I'm like, dude, wait. What type of example are you? He's like, you're lying. You flipped me off. I was like, I didn't flip you off. And I just can't comprehend. He knew what he was doing when he was acting like he was pulling the trigger at my head. And I don't know if he had a gun in the car or if he just felt like that would provoke me. But at one point, he pulled over behind me on the side of the street. Did it twice. And I leaned out of the window, like my torso's out of the car. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, I'm trying to go home. Leave me alone. And the police officer was next lane over. And I'm flailing, you know, like, just leave me alone. Let me go home. And, you know, I'm sensitive to it, so whatever. But police officer looked at me, and I felt like, you know, just cold stare, turned her head, and kept on driving. I'm doing, like, you know, halfway out of the car, the police officer's 15 feet away from me. If you saw that, wouldn't you stop? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand, like, certain experiences like that. I was with at a birthday party, and a guy barked at a police officer, and the police officer approached me, and I was in the limo, and he knew it wasn't me, but I was the easy target, and thankfully the limo driver put a barrier. He's like, I can't let you get in the limo. And I said, you know, I didn't say anything. Like, I haven't even been drinking. And the other guy was sitting right there, and he put his head in and kind of, you know, backed off. But just like, you know, these escalating situations or not paying attention when something's wrong, I just, you know, makes you makes you ask questions like, why?
Not getting the same equal treatment that
you would hope
the general public should get.
You don't know. I don't know, but I would hope. You know, I would hope that if you're flailing your arms at a police car that's 20 feet away from you, that police officer would pull over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got more stories, but that's most recent. You know what I mean? Yeah, I just thought of another one that was just creepy. I was driving through my neighborhood. I could cut through my neighborhood and drop my daughter off. I got a 1-year-old, as you all know, 13 months. She runs the house already. Man, she runs the house. She runs my life. Probably not my wife as much. But I'm just driving, and there were two police cars stacked up on side each other on my side of the road. And so I was like, okay, how do I get around them and not, you know, swerve and cause a... I don't even know that I should have to have that conversation, but split-second decision. I'm going to put on my turn signal, and I'm going to drive slowly around. And the police officer, for some reason, like... stuck out his tongue at me and then kind of did something weird with his hands. I'm just like, and I don't know if he was just messing, but whatever. But the feeling that I had was terror. Like, what the, like, why'd that happen? You know? And not that that put me in a,
versus like a wave and a welcome, yeah, like a smile.
Yeah. Not that it put me in danger, thankfully, but for the next 2 days, I was like, what was that? Like, do I need to, like, did I do something wrong? I'm questioning myself. You know, I'm not saying it was anything, but the feeling that I had for the next 2 days was, I was disturbed. Like, I didn't sleep well that night. Like, what was it? Why? You know? So, anyway, you know, definitely have had friends. I've been profiled. You know, there was a crime. There was a, I was dating my wife, and I married my high school sweetheart. We were out on our way to drop her off in a friend's car, and we got profiled. Three black guys. My wife is Hispanic. And police officer pulled us over. First thing he said, banged on my window, rolled it down. Are you okay? Asked her. She's like, yeah, I'm okay. I'm with my boyfriend, and I'm about to be late for my curfew. I was like, whoa, calm down. So she's yelling at the cop. I roll up the window. He goes to the first guy. He's like, yeah, you fit the profile for a robbery or something like that. And they pull him out of the car. They've got him outside, you know, press up against the car for a long time. Like, you know, crime happens. I get it. But, man, that's really uncomfortable. Have you guys ever been in a car?
I've gotten handcuffed, slammed into a police car with an escalating situation with where multiple police officers tackled me and slammed me.
Jesus.
This was on New Year's Eve a couple years ago. And it was the worst. Like you said, that feeling that doesn't leave. Like,
yeah.
That didn't leave me for a long time. And I didn't know what to do. I can't imagine that being an everyday feeling just by being outside or not even like, you know. So what happened was, it was New Year's Eve. There was our cab that we had called across the street. We were downtown Raleigh. And I was with my girlfriend at the time, and all the roads were closed down in downtown Raleigh for New Year's.
Yeah.
And so there was still like the pedestrian walk lights that would go on and off or whatever. And there's police officers that were kind of like directing people, pedestrians. And I was like holding my girlfriend like in the like elbow, like escort, you know, walking,
yeah,
escorting. And we crossed the street when there was not the walk signal. The officer hadn't waved us across, but there's thousands, no, hundreds of people, right? Like walking any which way. I don't know if he, what caused him to pick me out of the crowd, but he did and demanded for my ID. And I was like, well, did I commit a crime? Like what am I under arrest for?
Him,
right? He's like, why didn't you stop crossing the street when I told you to stop? And I was like, we were like already across the street by the time I even heard you. There's no cars. The road shut down. And he took it as talking back. He was just looking for...
Yeah, he was trying to find...
I'm sure he was tired of drunk people, you know, a long night, whatever it was. But he grabbed me, grabbed my arm. I kind of yanked my arm away, and then it was on, like, called back up. They made an example out of me and put me in handcuffs. It was the most helpless I've ever felt in my life for something that I was just like, sir, my taxi is right across the street right here. I'm just trying to get home safely with my girlfriend.
And that's crazy.
I can't imagine that, again, being like every single day worrying about something like that happening or being profiled because of your color.
Yeah.
Let alone, you know.
But you were, I mean, you felt it though. You know what I mean?
Now we got a leaf blower out here.
There's always something.
We're not in the studio.
Studio's almost worse.
We can take a quick break to grab a drink, refill, eat, whatever. Until this guy stops blowing. I don't even feel right being able to share that story. Because again, it's like...
But you know what? I think...
That's the closest I've felt to like feeling helpless and my freedom and rights just being stripped.
I think it's important to share that because you have a sensibility of understanding of helplessness.
And I got to the point where
hadn't happened to me before. That hasn't happened. I'd have a level of fury at police officers, not race related, that if that happened to me, like, hopefully what'll happen through all this, not even oversight, but like, I think maybe it was on the podcast I listened to, just the idea that how much training do they get? 6 weeks? And they're given a gun and they have impunity, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe their training needs to be a little bit longer. Like, would you let somebody, a regular boat captain, drive a battleship or nuclear submarine? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how much training do you have to be able to put people's lives in the palm of your hand, literally? You know, one decision can...
Could there be, like, psychoanalysis too?
Absolutely.
These people? Like,
you would
there
think.
There should be. I mean, I knew I grew up with kids in my high school who were like constant troublemakers. What did they grow up to be? Police officers.
Jesus.
It scares the crap out of me, honestly. Yeah. Like, it's really sad.
Campaign Zero is an organization that I want to provide support to and do some fundraising
for. Me too, for sure.
Here's the 10 things that they work on for policy solutions. Number one, end broken windows policing. 2, community oversight. 3, limit use of force. 4, independently investigate and prosecute. 5, community representation. 6, body cams filming the police. 7, focus on training. 8, end for-profit policing. 9, demilitarization. And 10, fair police union contracts. So, you know, they have a 10-part approach to how they can create reform and change to the policies and training that goes with the police force, you know.
And I think the other organization I mentioned that he's involved with as well is a subset of that, and that's specific. It has eight other specific measures that police forces can take.
I think, you know, they go on to talk about the legislation around that.
Yeah.
I think that's where you gotta like hold accountable for action. Like, the police are not above the law, right? And they are getting treated with like they are. They're not being held
forever
accountable for what they're doing. Like, and they're public servants at the end of the day. Are you serving the public or are you hurting the public?
Yeah. It's the whole idea of not even being like being the law, like judge and jury. I feel like that's what they feel like, the level of power that they have.
Entitlement.
It's pretty scary knowing that what you just said, the guys who were the troublemakers turned out to be police officers. I had this crazy experience with a couple police officers. Forgive me. I grew up a UNC fan, and a bunch of guys invited me over, and you know, I think they all went to App. One black guy, and he was in their fraternity, and the other one guy was a police officer, and he did some stuff that day that I I didn't know what was going to... He pulled a gun on the other black guy and called him N-word, just joking, and looked at me and laughed. I was like, I'm out of here. And I almost thought I had to use the restroom. I was that uncomfortable and ended up leaving. And turns out this guy was like, I don't know what the word is, indicted off the Durham police force, but he was telling stories about sicking dogs on black guys, you know, and doing stuff, you know, Dukes of Hazzard style, jumping over cars and jumping on people and putting them in headlocks and scratching up the car. And he's talking about the damage he's done to cars, like hitting people with cars and tackling people. And I'm just like, man, there's a callousness, a coldness this guy has it. I do not feel comfortable knowing that he's a police officer. So, I know what you were saying. Man, there's got to be another way. They need to go through another level of...
How do they properly vet, like, going back to, like, people a part of their lives, like their teachers and whatnot? Like,
yeah.
Would you allow this person?
Yeah.
You know, and people change. And that's another thing. Like, you got to be open to that, too. Like, people do change their mindsets. But there should be definitely like a probation period whenever you get brought onto the force. So like if you do something like, you know, wrong or like break the rules or whatever it may be, like,
or if
you
someone
gotta go, you gotta like start the program back over, like, or whatever
it may be. Yeah. That should be one strike if you gotta go. Yeah. I mean, and also, just like you said, the mental evaluation. I think all that stuff should be transparent. Maybe you shouldn't be able to look at someone's file about their, you know, what their scores were in certain aptitude or whatever, but we should be able to, I mean, there should be a rigorous process by which these people are evaluated. And they should be paid more. It is a dangerous job. There's no doubt about that. One of the things that DeRay said, that only 5% of crimes are violent. So the people who respond to the other calls shouldn't be heavily armed with tasers and guns. Like, most crime is nonviolent, so there needs to be a nonviolent division where people don't necessarily have hollow tip bullets. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes a mental health expert needs to show up to deal with the situation.
Mental health related.
Yeah. Maybe there's backup behind them, you know what I mean? Just in case the situation escalates.
More training around conflict resolution, how to communicate, how to talk to different types of people, like how to approach through words to de-escalate versus escalate, right?
Yeah.
Which they do, I'm sure, have some form of training on for, like, you know, these older cops who've moved up into, like, interrogation, or not interrogation, but, like, hostage negotiation type situations where they know how to...
Talk a situation down.
Yeah, absolutely.
You'd think so, but again, I think it goes back to there isn't sufficient training. You know, I think it's the same thing with like how easy it is to become a police officer and get a badge and a gun, right? It's probably the same. Check the box, like mental.
And like, how do we get in front of people who can make those decisions to implement those things?
I think it starts with research and educating yourself and taking the time to look for the organization specifically and what they stand for, and continue to have conversations with other people and figure out what needs to be done. What are the organizations actively doing that, and how do you support those organizations specifically?
Yeah, I think right now for the next bit, you know, the conversations and the research is important, but then it's got to be action. You know, I was disappointed in a prominent golfer's quote that there needs to be a conversation. I think, you know, he had an opportunity to say something about action, and I'm that guy's biggest fan, but that was disappointing because there was an opportunity to, you know, put his money behind it. You've seen corporations. I mean, my wife got me a Peloton in February. They're, you know, given $500,000 to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. That made me proud to be a Peloton owner. And there's been other companies, I think I saw Lyft did that, maybe Uber as well. So companies that are putting resources and money really, because that's what these organizations need, behind good causes, I think, is key. So for individuals, I think the learning opportunity is what we need to do over the course. I don't think there's a, I was about to say over the course of the next 6 months, probably forever, you know?
It's going to take years.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
Of dedication mm-hmm. to it. Because it's taken years to get to this point, right?
Yeah, centuries. Yeah, literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully it doesn't fall into the background noise that of what Nick's week's headlines will become. News cycle. I know you see that over and over again.
I think so. For me personally, a tough part of this is like conversations with the older people in my family. Of like, I think it's a lot of it is kind of embedded generationally into your age too. Like, you're a product of your environment. You're a product of what you grew up in.
Yeah,
I think younger people are used to, in
black
terms of
black people,
and you know, I think
open-mindedness, you know, all that stuff,
to where you don't even view it as a thing. A, that's probably a problem of, like, again, not being educated on what is actually going on, and going back to privilege of not needing to, right? So stripping that away, but I think what I'm trying to say is that the majority of people are sick and tired of racism and are wanting that to end, right? And but the older demographic,
I think we know it's never going to end.
It's never going to end. But the older demographic, like, having those conversations of, like, yo, it's not okay to make a joke that involves prejudice and bias. Like, that joke is not funny, you know? And, like, I don't want to, like, name any names, but, you know, people that say they are not racist but then contradict themselves by how they respond to a news article or, like, a person that's walking down the street. Or,
and they call themselves, I mean, because they're not overt. Again, they're not
supremacists. They're not outwardly.
Right.
Right. So, I don't know.
Yeah, the whole concept of my brain's been doing somersaults over the concept of, you know, the term we hear a lot, white privilege. You know, one of my, one of the guys who played for me while I was coaching at Duke, I mean, we're super close. I caddied for him at first, second, and third stage of Q school back in 2018, and he got through. But, so, I mean, real close with the family. You know, he was just talking about not seeing race and, you know, not liking the concept, not liking the term white privilege and things of that nature. We were going back and forth through text. I'm going to see him this weekend. We'll spend some time together. But, you know, I think it's, I think white privilege is an unfortunate term because I don't know if it's necessarily a privilege. You know, you didn't get anything. You were just born. I just think that there's certain embedded advantages, you know, and certain disadvantages that you don't have to deal with. And I'm not sure it's not your fault. It's certainly not my fault that I don't necessarily have them. But at the same time, I think there's discussion around understanding what certain head starts or certain leads or advantages are that one group of people has, another group of people doesn't have. I think that's helpful. Mm-hmm. I think hopefully conversations like this allow that to happen on an honest level because, you know, any one of you guys may be like, man, I don't feel like I had benefited. You know, life wasn't that easy for me. I didn't grow up member of whatever country club and driving whatever car and certain, like, things weren't, and I respect that. You know, there's levels of, you know, there's class, there's wealth, there's privileges, all that stuff, the advantages that come with, you know, the family that you were born to. I think honest and deep conversations to peel back the layers.
I think the workplace is a great example of that too. Just opportunity for careers and jobs and the whole interview process and hiring portion where you see a friend of mine's article, a friend of mine wrote an article, it's called Seeing Into the Dark. And one of the things he talked about was a study done by Harvard Business Review. Since 1990, white applicants received on average 36 more callbacks than black applicants with identical resumes.
Wow.
I mean, if you think about that number, 36 out of, you know, 36%
more times.
Right. Like what that actually means and what that means for the positions that are getting filled and how that translates into everything in life.
Wealth.
Yeah.
School, education, you know, comfort, security, retirement, all that stuff. Yeah, when you, that's the one thing. That's an area that's a scary, you know, thing when you talk about jobs and hiring and stuff like that.
That's income, right? That's,
oh, man.
That's
generational wealth. Yeah.
It's how you build, even just like...
Now, we didn't even talk about wealth. It's just security.
Security,
you know, I mean?
Mental health, yeah. Self-fulfillment.
Mental health.
Nowadays.
Worth.
Purpose, it's, worth. Mm-hmm. Providing for others,
yeah.
And then also, yeah.
I mean, this is probably gonna get me in trouble, but I mean, how many head pros do we know who are?
One.
I almost said. One. Well, I was just gonna say that aren't very well qualified.
Oh, okay.
That
sorry.
We feel like anybody off the street could do their job. You know what I mean? That don't. They're not dedicated. They're not passionate. It has nothing to do with color, but I wonder if there's other people of color who could step into that role if given the opportunity. And we're just talking about golf. We're not talking about, good Lord, every
legislation.
Every ending, I mean, good Lord.
Because it seems to be now, like, you hear it all the time, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And so, like,
if the power structure is such that
it's networked like that, then, like, it's going to be a never ending process.
Yeah.
What can be done differently? So, you know, that statistic around identical resumes, like, that's staggering.
Yeah.
How do you start with breaking that down, right?
I think people in the decision-making room have to be people of color, you know, mm-hmm. and certainly women. I think the people at the table have to have equal voice. And based on my experience, you know, sometimes there's... Even with a diverse room, the person at the top is the voice that matters, and so they'll take the feedback, but they're gonna, mm-hmm. you know, go whatever way they
feel comfortable
with.
It's more so like they feel good that they involved a diverse panel, but ultimately they're still making the shots.
Yeah, my mother talks about that a lot with where she works and in hiring, and she'll be called into the room, and she feels like she was brought in to check a box, but didn't really have any authority with regard to the hire that was made.
That's a good point to translate. I'll kind of switch a little bit over to the article letter that Maurice Allen wrote to Golf Digest.
Yeah.
Really worth the read if you have not read it yet. And that was one of the things he had talked about, is checking the box, showing up for events, basically fake promises of support and feeling like he is basically checking a box for these organizations to say they represent a black athlete.
When the camera's on or when people are in the room, they'll bring him in. But then when it's for further support, sponsorship, whatever, he doesn't get a call back. Yeah.
Red tape.
Yeah.
The golf is not the issue here, obviously, but it
that's
is an
brought us here, though.
But golf is showcases the issue on a grand scale. Golf is very much a traditionally elitist and white dominated sport. The country club atmosphere has been around for centuries as well, as well as back to the history and roots of golf, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oppression's been a part of that. So in terms of golf, I don't know, like, broaching that subject, how do we, you know, for me personally, I want to start reaching out and trying to find more golfers in the community who are black and try and play golf with them, you know, and self-reflection, looking at who I play golf with a lot of the time. It's like, but like, yeah. How do I start to branch out more and like actively search and try and, you know, so the first tee, that's how we met. Right. That was one of the first things I did moving to Raleigh and going to NC State was volunteer for the first tee. And I got exposed to communities and people that I wouldn't otherwise meet. Yeah. Right. So yeah. How do I facilitate that as a business? How do I, as an individual, try, you know, and like, yeah. I don't know.
It's funny. I laugh because the first tee has it all embedded in its structure as well. A few years ago, let's call it 40 employees, 17 were let go and 16 were black. And it was like kind of the community-based, not community-based, but the life skills-based, relationship-driven people in the organization. It was heavy and it has not been reported. Like that company, that organization was gutted of its, I don't want to say its soul because there's still some good people there. But, yeah, that was painful. I got a call. I was at the U.S. Open, I think. Maybe I was at Shinnecock. I don't know. But a friend called me and said, did you hear what happened? Talk me through it. It was pretty crazy. So, but anyway, to get back to what you're saying, you know.
Are there other foundations that you know of that are out there?
No. There's individuals, there's small groups. I think there's a local one. I don't know it very well. I think they're doing some outside of the first tee. I was first employee for the first tee around here. The organization has a piece in my heart, always will. You know, some stuff I experienced as executive director of the first tee of the Triangle was unfortunate. And race was a direct correlation, and in my mind, for me moving on, some race related stuff was injected in that, but that's not for now. You know, but in terms of for you, man, beyond golf, you know, I know you're a certain place. I just think that the power that you have is not in playing golf, but with regard to what you do as a business. I mean, you know, some collaborations, you know, like, screw playing golf, unless you're going to play with somebody who you're going to let them beat you. I don't know, you can't do that yet. But I mean, like a collaboration that puts money in your pocket and a person of color's pocket, I think that would be cool. You know, there's some, is it Roger? Is that his mm-hmm. name? Yeah, Roger. I met him through you when he was in town. I mean, I don't know if there's opportunity there, but you know, there's people who are trying to do some things in golf. That's the, y'all go play.
Those are the voices you want to help elevate, right?
Yeah. Well, and go make some money together. You know what I mean? Like do a project together, go make some money because you know, it's just like your security, his security, exposure. That's what moves the needle because as more money he has, the more money you have, you know, your voice is, and your perspective is elevated. And those are the type of, you know, statements from me to you. It's not easy because you're probably like, what the hell? Now I got a new assignment. How do I do that? I'm trying to run a business. But at the same time, I think that's kind of sort of where we are. Mm-hmm. Like putting action behind it. You know, I think my buddy Ty reached out to you at the PGA show. I've been dying to figure out a way to get some of his. He's just a creative dude. When mm-hmm. He was executive director in Houston when I was here, and he would make these videos just kind of showcasing his chapter and stuff, and have a music overlay. His brother is a world-renowned jazz musician, Jason Moran. So he'd put jazz and like kids swinging and cool, real cool angles and like, man, I'm a crappy executive director of this guy. You know? He's just ultra talented. But, you know, I love to see people like that who are in golf and love the space, have the opportunity. He was one of the guys who was, you know, lost his position at the first tee. So anyway, that's what I think.
Collaboration, yeah, working together on causes.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be about the money for us, and like definitely would want to create money generating
opportunities, yeah.
Right? But it's more about the impact and the narrative and changing the narrative and having action behind the narrative.
Yeah, he's gonna have to give me a tutorial. Have you seen his stuff on Instagram about club the twirl game?
Oh, Roger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't twirl a club to save my life. It's pathetic.
Well, you need to hit more shots than required.
Hey, man, I made a hole in one like a couple weeks before the pandemic hit. I didn't twirl a club. I threw it, you know? But I don't know how to. I need a lesson. You guys got
I hit bad shots and still twirl a club. Like,
same way.
Yeah. I'd do it if I could. I hit good shots. And, I get it and I cock it. And I like, and the kids, I work with kids, so they laugh at me. They're like, you're spinning awesome. The top. Yeah. I spin it and I drop the club. Like,
you're
that is not
your
a twirl.
That might be next.
Ah, here you go.
Like dropping the mic. Yeah. After a hole in one, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I know, right? I won the bet, so that's all it really mattered that day.
Do you have something?
Yeah, like you talked about the first tee and like 16 out of 17 people who were let go, and it wasn't really reported on.
Yeah.
What do you think? Like, well, how the role of media or lack thereof plays in the overall like communication of racism and.
Well, do you think? I mean, golf specific or. Media in general. Wow, that's a big question. I mean, obviously, good Lord. Again, I don't want to call it the power structure, but the people making
networks,
the decisions. I mean, think of the people who are making the decisions, right? I mean, obviously, they have to follow the news cycle. But doing an in-depth report from the Golf Channel about what happened at the first tee, they're trying to figure out what's going on at the next,
right.
What Tiger's doing next week. You know what I mean? They're trying to move the needle for ratings instead of trying to expose
true journalism at,
right.
Like, at all levels, I guess. Is
right, right,
like,
right.
How do we like get back to that? I guess is what my overall question. And
newspapers are shutting down. I think that there's some independent sources out there that are doing
like
good work.
And things like that.
Yeah, and like I'm a sports nut, so like the Undefeated and. Stuff like that. ESPN even does some good reporting. There's a decent amount out there. It's just not mainstream, you know. But in terms of race in general, it's so hard. I can't remember. I was listening to sports radio yesterday, and a broadcaster was talking about how he doesn't like. I think he was saying like federally mandated policies, like individual accountability. I mean, I think, unfortunately, federally mandated institutions and systems are what got us here. So I think there needs to be a federal mandate to move us away from it, or in the other direction. But and it has, you know. But in terms of media, that's tough. Who wants to hear a quasi-depressing story about, people being wronged? I think, good Lord, I could use some good news.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? I'm certainly not the...
I don't know what expert. To think. I think people publish stories to move the needle on their acceptance and liking... by the overall public, I do think some
and their
people,
readership, right?
Yeah. I do think stories do get covered that are controversial and should be exposed. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, like, can more of those? How do we get more? Shed more light on like some of these localized issues, like the first team, maybe like, I don't know, like.
Man, I don't know that. mean, shoot.
Because
I mean, a lot of people don't want to talk about it. If you're let go and you're an upper level executive at the first tee and you're black and two people come to mind, and they probably just flaming furious. Like, I don't want to talk about this organization. I don't want to give them the opportunity to respond. I just want to go be successful elsewhere and move on with my life.
That's intimidation. I've invested, that's
yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah.
And you know, with this situation, we're encouraged to like start these conversations and dialogue, and that's why.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Like, it is tough to see, but should it be shown? Should it be highlighted? I mean,
truthfully,
is it too hard?
We wouldn't know if there wasn't cameras in everybody's hands these days, you know, about police violence. Known about it my entire life. I just hadn't seen it like this. You know what I mean? I can remember driving down Glenwood Avenue growing up, slowing down when I saw a scuffle. Like, the guy was literally laying on the front of the hood with his hands behind his back, and the police jump on him. Like, what precipitated that? Like, there's nothing he could have said that warranted two or three cops pulling him on the ground and beating on him, you know? So
yeah.
I just think that in that case... in the case of police brutality, thank God for the documentation of it now. In terms of the rest of it, man.
I think it does come down to the people with platforms, and that could be an individual, it could be a business, it could be a media company, have the courage to surface some of these stories.
Like, yeah.
Have those conversations, have those stories. Start the conversation, even if it's difficult or against the grain, or calling out big companies. They're not like shouldn't be immune anymore to these types of actions.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm at a place where I'm about to launch a new program. Hopefully it'll get some exposure. I was looking at a couple companies, golf companies, that I was going to talk to about, you know, being on staff and wearing their logo and stuff like that. And I think Nike made the strongest push, you know? And, I mean, there's so much that kind of buoyed me a little bit. I felt good. I was like, man, Nike, I'm proud of Nike for doing that. At the same time, Nike has some really crappy business practices. So I think on end of the spectrum, I think there's it's such a tough dynamic to balance all this stuff. 'Cause just like humans, there's good and bad, you know? Nobody's perfect.
Yeah. Joey, I think you have some perspective that's important to share, too, if you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah. So I have three adopted black brothers.
Wow. Where'd you grow up?
In Raleigh.
Okay.
Yeah, like 20 minutes from here. So growing up, I mean, all this stuff kind of hit. It was when Trayvon Martin got killed.
Yeah.
However long ago that was, pretty recent. My older brother posted on Facebook about his experiences. And growing up, I never saw color. Like, these are my brothers. Like, that was it. Like, I didn't see anything other than that. Love them dearly. Still do. Will always.
Your family.
Yeah. And reading the post, it's just, he kind of said the same things as you, man. Like, he's driving through neighborhoods. The next thing you know, he's up against a car with cops on for being black. And I never talked to him about that. Like, I never thought to, because...
Did he ever mention it to you?
Never.
Yeah.
And looking at it now, I feel bad because I never saw it that way, but I never have experienced it, like you just said. And
well, I think just, you know, I think as a black guy, there's a level of embarrassment and shame, you know?
That's what he said.
Like, why was I chosen, you know?
I'm not sure I understand.
That me?
Well, and then at the same time, I mean, there's a level of the same thing, kind of, sort of. We gotta keep that.
Siri's always listening.
But yeah, just, I mean, reading that, and
what do you say? Like, what do you say? Just what was reading the experiences? Did he have multiple experiences?
He said he's had multiple and he's never felt comfortable talking about it until Trayvon Martin. Yeah. And he felt just pushed to come out with it. And, you know, I messaged him right away and was like, man, why didn't you ever say something? Like, I never knew. And he's like, I never felt comfortable with it. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't know how to.
Yeah.
And it just sucks so much to hear that, because it's like, I felt like I was so close with him.
And you're like, I feel like I'm in your corner.
I'm getting married in 10 days. He's my best man. And it's like, I wish we could talk about that. And I got dinner with my little brothers last night. He was supposed to be there and couldn't make it. He was working. But I talked to them about it and was like, look, guys, like, we need to talk about this more often. Like, I'm sorry for not bringing it up earlier, because I never saw it that way. Like I said earlier, like, these are my brothers. That was it. Yeah. Like, I love you guys. And I don't know what else to say about it other than I feel terrible for not
Bringing it up. You know, I think the curtain has kind of been, not even opened, it's been ripped off, you know? And so I just think the scars and the sins are kind of right in front of us now. And so, you know, applaud you for willingness to look at yourself. At the same time, I just think it takes it's gonna take some time probably for them to open up, because it's painful, you know what I mean? Like, those experiences, just talking about a little bit, I talked about my hair standing up, you know what I mean? I'm chest is tight, and now I've got a grandmother who's 86 years old who grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina. She's been through some shit. I mean, she mentioned it real briefly. She's like, yeah, I went to the beach with a family when I think she was 16 to care for their kids. I said, what? You know, this is when the beaches were segregated and she was the help. I said, what was that like? And she wouldn't talk about it. And I've asked her about other things and she won't talk about it. And I think it's, I'm like, history buff, I want to hear about these things. She won't talk about it. I just think there's a level of pain. She won't open up to me. She's not going to open up to other people. Like, there's a project going on, I think Washington Elementary downtown, I think that's the right one. It was the black elementary school for a while. I think she went there. And they want to interview some people who are still alive and talk about their experiences. She can't do it. That's crazy to me, you know? I mean, that's not the recent past, but it's just kind of like an understanding of, you know, kind of what you're going to encounter with your brothers, because, you know, you hear the word microaggressions. They're probably little micro experiences they've had that are hard to explain. It's like, I certainly have those. Certainly on a monthly basis, maybe on a weekly basis, where it's like, did I do something? Did I say something? Do I smell bad? Did I, you know, like, well, what else is there? You know what I mean? Yeah, man, love on your brothers, and I'm sure they'll love you back for it.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's crazy. I think, you know, there's a lot wrong with society. I think it's the same way when, you know, homophobia and sexism, you know, I'm sure we all know what women go through in our society at times, and certainly it's gotten better over the past 3 to 5 years, but it's still awful. But man, I know some scumbag guys, you know, and I think that holistically people need to hold people in their circle accountable. You know, somebody like me, you know, I cut people like that out of my life over time. I don't know if that was the right thing to do. I think I need to hold them accountable and then cut them out of my life. You know what I mean? Call them out. And so I think that's what our new kind of action step is. When we're doing research and learning and looking for opportunities to partner and talk, but when we hear it, whatever it is, we got to call people out on it. I think on an individual basis, that'll that'll change things. The young man
have the courage to do it.
Man, it's tough.
It takes a lot of courage. It's tough. But there should be no choice anymore.
Yeah. 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 It's tough. We're going to miss opportunities, I tell you what. But I think the important part is just to come back to it. And if you got to revisit it later, you're like, man, that was not appropriate. I can't stand for that, man. If you're going to be that type of person, I'm not going to be in your life. Not even, I'm saying man, because we're a bunch of men sitting around here, but it might not be men. Unfortunately, the young man I was telling you about that we were texting back and forth, he's like, I just think they'll die out eventually. And I think, unfortunately, that, you know, the isms, racism, sexism, all that stuff, they're ingrained and they need to be ripped out in the sense of called out. And, you know, I don't know if shaming is the right word, but you know what I'm saying.
I think, yeah, a lot of people think it's someone else's problem to correct and don't take action, or there's fear, yeah. But the idea that it'll die out, that's...
it means it's not my responsibility.
That, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that. I'm going to get him when I see him. He's going to be like, darn it. Why'd you have that conversation? Now you put more pressure on me. I don't know. I mean, you know, here's the tough part, right? Because, so, my wife is, her mom's from Ecuador, dad's Italian American, and she's brown skin. When she's in the sun, she's really brown skin, when she's not. But so she's been kind of on both sides of it. Like, she's been seen as white and seen as not white. So she's heard some things where people have assumed she was white, that about Hispanic people and black people and whatever. And she's a monster. She's a beast. So she'll call somebody out. I'm sure there was times where she didn't. But, like, I think that the hard question, the hard conversation is, what do you guys hear on a regular basis? Like, what is out there? I think that's exposing it and talking about it, even dropping names. I mean, mm-hmm. Man, I had an experience at a charity event where a board member of mine, when I was with the first team, made a comment that was literally the most... He told a joke talking about, like, this great amateur golfer who was from North Carolina. I cannot remember his name. A guy who played in the match against, like, Ben Hogan. He was, like, Ken Venturi and I think the other amateur against Ben Hogan and the other pro. I think that's the guy, but he was, like, a great name from North Carolina. And he said a racist joke about, you know, a black pilot driving a plane upside down, but he didn't say the word black. And the guy said it in front of me, and again, sucked the air out of me. I said, are you serious? I yelled at him, like, lost my shit. And I said, what you don't know is my grandfather was a war hero. He was a Tuskegee Airman. And I mean, I did my best to shame him, you know what I mean? But he's reached out to me a bunch of times. I don't want to have anything to do with that guy. You know what I mean? But that's just what I heard. Who knows how many other times he's told that joke
to people that are in his circle.
Yeah.
That, you know what I mean?
Or other jokes or other things. And
worse
so,
things.
Way worse, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's mm-hmm. you know, pulling that. Man, what's out there? Like, what do you guys hear? What this is a tough part. I think that's the tough part. And then maybe it needs to be on my desk too. Like, what do I hear? Because it comes from all sides, man. Especially, I mean, you know, coming up in an interracial couple in the 90s, my girlfriend, now wife, and I felt some stuff. And I would say the majority of the things that come to mind quickly, one was from a white guy, more of it's from black people. And I don't know if it's racism or prejudice or just the lack of willingness to accept an interracial couple, but it goes both ways. And some of that stuff came from family, and I'm kind to them, but I probably haven't forgiven them yet, you know what I mean? But yeah, I think, I mean, I it's probably a tough conversation to have, but like, what's really out there?
Yeah. I think a lot of what we hear being in typically like on the golf course or in society in general, you know, it's easy to be in white only circles where you hear jokes or generalizations or just off the cuff comments that they think are fleeting or not damaging, that in the past, you know, if like let slide or just brush off or even partake in, you know, as shitty as it sounds, like partake in laughing about it because you're in a group, you know, and it's like
peer pressure.
Yeah. I mean, I think back to college years and even so high school years, right? Like our high school, I grew up in upstate New York in the countryside, and we didn't, there was one black student in our entire school district. She was adopted as well. And the amount of hate that that family and jokes about that family that adopted her received, like, it's just stuff like that.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And yes, like hearing jokes and things because they're not a part of the community. It's like this scapegoat group.
What do we think that is? Do we think, is that fear? Is that embedded racism? Is this country racist? Like, what is that coming from? Is that
ignorance and, I don't know.
Definitely embedded. I think,
is it hatred? Is it like, I mean, there's sometimes I wonder if not everything's white and black, but I wonder if I mean, there's differences in our cultures, you know what I mean? I wonder if our cultures can coexist. Obviously they can, because I'm here, but you know, there are some differences that
parenting is a big thing too, like, yeah. I think, yeah, your responsibility as a parent is to start these conversations when your kid can start, yeah, formulating words, right? Like having these conversations and choosing books, like children's books that promote diversity, choosing toys that are diverse, and like exposing, yeah, TV shows, you, yeah, know, that are diverse TV shows, and, you know, just having these difficult conversations early when it is being, you can ingrain this, yeah, and
yeah, even like music, man, I have such a problem with music now because I'll listen to stuff that I wouldn't feel comfortable with one of the kids that I play in front of them, you know, lyrics and stuff, and you know, the over the line stuff, we're talking about a trap queen. I definitely don't listen to that and support it, but there's other layers of, you know, popular hip hop rap music. That's about all I listen to, that and jazz and R&B and stuff like that. But you know, it's problematic. I mean, I just, you know, it's so deep, all this stuff.
Yeah, I think it's changing what the environment looks like for someone, because people are a product of their environment. So yeah, how do you change that environment that people are in where they're establishing these biases or thoughts? You know, like, where does that start exactly? How do you promote more inclusive communities and programming and exposure and... I don't know, like, again, growing up, and there's a lot of America that's just all white, yeah, America, right?
Yeah.
In terms of country pockets and rural towns and things like that. Like, how do you educate?
Yeah, like, I grew up in a small town, Statesville. It's very different. Like, when I go home, it's like I'm in another world.
Yeah.
There's still divide. I mean, I went to a predominantly black high school, and in high school there were, I mean, fights not only between blacks and whites, but blacks and Mexicans, Mexicans and whites. It was just tension at all times. So it was crazy. And then you come to a place like Raleigh, and there's like more progressive thinking and more open-mindedness.
The shitty part about, I mean, Raleigh and the South in general is there is this like embedded history of racism that is passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah, and I will say right now, like, my grandparents have said colorful things, and it's, you know, like, I guess growing up, like, how do you become, like, an authoritative figure over your grandparents, you know, like, and so, like, as you get older, like, your eyes get bigger, hopefully, and your heart gets bigger.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting. I mentioned my grandfather, you know, World War II, came back, treated awful, you know, passed over for promotions in the Air Force his entire career, but made a really good life. I have my mom, and she has two sisters and a brother. And in terms of just well-versed, diverse family, like, if you saw a picture of my family, it's pretty crazy. Like, my aunt's married to a red-haired white guy, you know, and they have a kid who looks like a combination of all, just mix us up in a bowl, and he's a pretty amazing kid, goes to Colorado College. My uncle was married to an Italian woman, Italian-American woman, now is married to a Jamaican woman, and then my other aunt was married to an Italian man, so, you know, and then you go down another generation, the mixes and stuff like that, so, but my grandfather didn't carry, like, race stuff. I don't think I ever heard him say anything negative about, you know, white people, no matter what. And I contrast that with other sides of my family where it was constant and maybe justified. I don't know, but there was a level of hurt and pain that came out a lot, you know? And you know, probably they're contrasting who I am at times, you know? But you know, thinking about my grandfather, he just has to, he's a really special person to be able to go through the things that he went through in the segregated military, you know, and then to come back and raise the family he did. And so as it applies to, you know, that generation, you know, they didn't grow up in integrated schools, you know. They certainly weren't taught anything in school that would deter them from conventional wisdom or knowledge or stereotypes and stuff like that. Hell, everything was legalized. You know, it was state-sponsored racism, basically. So, I don't know. Maybe Max is right. A few generations, it'll die out. I just think, like you said, you know, education and putting people in situations where they have to interact with people from other cultures will...
And make promises to each other to work towards this shared vision of love and...
Yeah. And holding people
accountable.
Following through.
Look up that website. It's 8. I just want to say it.
What is it?
It has a number. It's, look up that guy's name again. Deray. D-E-R-A-Y. D-E-R-A-Y. Yeah. So he's got, there's another, so one of them is.
8 Reforms.
Yes. This one? That's the one. But if there's a website for it, good Lord, what is that picture? Is it 8 Can't Wait? That might be
it. 8 Can't Wait.
Yeah. Will you go to that website? Oh, there were the 8 things. It's crazy that they say just those 8 things can reduce homicides. Ban strangleholds and chokeholds, require de-escalation, require a warning before shooting, exhaust all other means before shooting, they have a duty to intervene, ban shooting at moving vehicles, require use of force, continuum, require comprehensive reporting. That's crazy. They sound simple, right? I mean, he said that the mayor and the police chief can make a decision on those almost immediately. That's pretty crazy.
That was something I was thinking about previously in today's conversation, was the lack of good leadership.
Yeah.
Man,
that's, you know, a rabbit hole.
Basically, these people in positions of power and leadership are protecting their own versus protecting what it's doing to society and to Black people specifically.
Even the whole concept of, I mean, guys help me out, like the whole concept of capitalism, you know, like socialism is a scary word, but I don't know the nuances of capitalism or communism or whatever, but I think when we look at, you know, these hunter-gatherer societies and around the world or in previous generations, that, you know, no one was trying to be rich. No one was trying to, you know, own a mansion or join a country club.
People,
yeah, yeah,
take
yeah.
Their own.
Yeah, low-wage labor, free labor, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, I think television and, like, harping back on media, like, just personally, I think they have a way of driving, like, you need the next biggest, baddest thing, like, and so, like, in their mind, that's what they're after, is it's a very me society,
yeah,
like, me first type thing.
To sum it up from our end, we're, as an organization, focused, again, back on police brutality and the structural racism that is in place, and we urge everyone to do their own research into organizations. We are focused on two thus far and still continuing to research other organizations. One is a local one in Durham, North Carolina, Emancipate North Carolina, which is again about dismantling structural racism and mass incarceration across North Carolina. The other one is Campaign Zero, which is attacking the policies when it comes to police response and training and what goes into all of those policies, right?
Yeah.
And guidance on that. And those are things that police forces can adopt. So continuing to support those organizations. Find, there's plenty more out there.
Plenty. Great. Every city, every major city, every smaller, even local localities. Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely urge both supporting national, but even more so taking a look at what are the local organizations in your community.
And change isn't easy. Obviously, seeing this desire for police brutality to end, meet some resistance, because not only, probably, I'm sure the police feel threatened, and you know, there's really two main emotions. There's fear and there's love. They're probably really fearful of what, you know, the result might be. But at the same time, I think that beyond them, there's some, I don't want to call them evil people, but, you know, people out there in power who like the idea of a military state and heavily armed police officers. So we've got to get through both of those layers to, you know, create change. So I don't think this is going to be an easy fight. I think it's going to be trench warfare. It's going to be some years, and I think it's going to be mean strategy, and I think we're all going to have to do our part and learn and listen. And
maybe I think another thing too is taking your right to vote seriously and doing your research into the leaders that are being elected into, the positions are being elected into, as well as taking a look at the leadership that is in specific positions and if they're contributing to the problem or adding to the solution and the change.
Yeah. I think this is, you know, fortunately, unfortunately, this cause will be on the ballot. It will be a stance that people have to be transparent about going forward.
Have the difficult conversations, call people out.
Yeah.
Accountability.
Make sure that you are thinking of inclusivity in all that you do and making sure that you're not inadvertently or advertently excluding in programming or actions or, you know what I mean?
Partnerships, hiring, all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Be proactive. I think that's the key. It requires a new way of thought and new actions. So. Yeah.
Appreciate you taking the initiative to reach out and wanting to have this conversation and letting us listen and learn and contribute. And we're here to always listen and learn and advocate and align. So
I appreciate it. I appreciate you all giving me the opportunity. moves the needle, that moves us closer to where we want to be, which is just equality, not even nothing more than that, just equality.